Session number 340902.
I was going to ask you about the setup for continuous monitoring. So, were there a group of people at the post 24 hours a day, 7 days
now,
a week?
No, the Observer Corps in World War II was a mixture of full time and spare time. The full time observers tended to man the posts in the daytime, and the spare time observers manned the post in the evenings and at weekend. After 1947, when the Corps was reformed, because it stood down on the 12th of May 1945, and for a year and a bit there was no Observer Corps. 1st of January 1947 it was reformed. The big difference was that it was nearly totally spare time, just administered by about 100 full-time people. So we're all spare time, nearly all spare time, operating in the way that I've explained before. Training exercises every week, live exercises on the post with real aircraft, and we just operated like that for the duration of our training meeting or our training exercise. We were never called out seriously to man the post in a wartime condition because we didn't have a war. The role mainly between 1947 and 1955 was to pick up the low-level intruder. They recognised that it wasn't really necessary for us to pick up high-flying aircraft because radar was doing that satisfactorily. So we were there to pick up and fill in the gaps that radar couldn't pick up. So it was mainly the low-level intruder. And of course by 1955 aircraft was fading and nuclear reporting was coming in. So that was the setup.
Right. Was there a national air traffic control service when you were during that period, or was there some sort of military and civil?
The truth is, I don't know about that. Right. Because that wasn't my field. But I assume that there may well have been some sort of national air traffic control because aircraft did fly down corridors from a relatively early stage. And they must have been controlled in some way. It may have been a lot cruder than now, but I'm assuming that that aircraft flying over the UK would have been flying down controlled corridors. So, yeah, there would have been much more like that. But military aircraft, I think, always did, in those days, to a degree, fly where they wanted to. I mean, in some instances, we would have an aircraft reporting exercise, and the RAF would fly an aeroplane around a group continuously, one aeroplane, just to give the observers practice in plotting aeroplanes. Now, that is really bizarre, but that's what happened. I have a record in my notes for the Truro group, for the Cornwall, and a Sunderland flying boat actually took off from Mount Batten in Plymouth and flew around Cornwall continuously for about 4 hours just to let the observers report it. Which is, as I say, a little bizarre nowadays.
Was everyone training it, doing their training at the same time or at a similar time, so that aircraft was utilised by every post in Cornwall?
We would have an exercise on a specific day in a specific time zone. All the observers would man their posts as if it was for real, so they would all be on duty. All the post lines, telephone lines, were switched, because normally the post lines were not switched. But on an exercise, they would be switched. So everything was live, but just for the duration of the exercise. And the RAF would know that, of course, and they would be commissioned to fly around just for the exercise, and things like that. Sometimes ROC exercises, aircraft exercises, were held in conjunction with RAF exercises, where the RAF practiced rats and terriers, they call them, friendly aircraft and enemy aircraft. So the RAF will be practicing at the same time as the Observer Corps was practicing. So that's how it went off. Mm-hmm. Well, the big thing was, the big difference between the wartime and afterwards is the Observer Corps was nearly all spare time. Right. So that was that.
Okay. How many hours a week or how much time a week would you say that a post would be manned?
We were committed, and I think we had to sign up to this, we had to do a minimum of 2 hours training a week. But on top of that, you had about five or six exercises, which normally ran for 8 to 12 hours. One or two went overnight, so they'd be 24 hours. And there would be, as I said, between 4, 6 or 8 exercises a year. And you would be expected to man in those exercises at some point or another. Clearly the people like officers, chief observers and leading observers, who had administration to do, or they had lessons to prepare, of a whole variety of things, people to interview, people to recruit. We were always very sociable as well. We had dinners, we had meetings, we had trips to RAF stations. So you had it all together, and probably in hours per week, certainly the NCOs and officers were putting in a lot more than 2 hours. So it was quite an intense thing. Possibly the same as the TA is today. There was a lot of commitment there.
So as well as the training every week, did you have to commit to a rota of being as an observer at that post for an evening or a daytime or commit to a certain period of time?
Don't forget, the post itself was unmanned all the time except on exercise.
Okay.
Or unless it was used for a training meeting. Mm. So it would just be there, but it would be unmanned, empty, locked up. And that was it. It would only be used for that time. When there was a meeting or an exercise, all the observers were expected to attend at some time, and there would be a rota set up for that. For example, if there was a 12-hour exercise, the operational crew for aircraft was only two. You only needed two. Very often there was three or four on. But if the post strength was 10 or 12, or 16 for that matter, then you would have four on for 4 hours. They would go home, another four would come on, or two would come on. It was fairly relaxed in terms of who attended when, but there would be a rota system, and obviously the chief observer was responsible for ensuring that the post was manned satisfactorily for the duration of the exercise, with the specified number of people there. But all too often they were overmanned because people were enthusiastic and wanted to man. It did get a problem in the nuclear days, which was regarded as much more boring than the aircraft days, and some posts had difficulty manning for the full duration of the exercise. So that was the setup there.
How did you fit in your role with your employer? So did you work for the National Coal Board?
Well, I did then. Yeah, I worked for National Coal Board. The National Coal Board were actually very good employers from the point of view of giving time off to indulge, if that's the right word, extra activities like the Royal Observer Corps. They themselves had a system of industrial civil defence. In fact, I was actually part of the colliery civil defence team as well as being in the Observer Corps. If I had to go away for a week-long course or a three-day course, then the National Coal Board would very often give me extra days leave to do that. So they're very supportive in that way. Don't forget that normally all the activities of the Observer Corps would be out of work time. All the training evenings were in the evening, 7 till 9. Exercises were at weekends. They were very, very rarely held in the week. So getting time off wasn't an issue, apart from certain specific things like a course or whatever. But the Coal Board are very good with that. Some employers were not. Very often private employers were not very good at giving the staff time off. And sometimes teachers had difficulty getting time off because obviously they were committed to the classroom on a daily basis. So it depended very much on what your job was, who your employer was. But the Coal Board was very good.
Okay. Shall we talk about your move to Cornwall and how you moved from...
Well, parallel with my Royal Observer Corps life, I'd got an industrial life. I'd got a professional life. By this time, I was a chartered mineral surveyor. I was a qualified mining surveyor. I was the deputy chief surveyor at Rufford Colliery. I'd moved from Lidworth by now, so I was working away as a mining surveyor. Around about 1968, I actually transferred to the area headquarters at a place called Edwinstowe, and I momentarily became a mine planner. In those days, there was a lot of people who had been trained very well on the National Coal Board were seeking other employment because the National Coal Board was actually contracting slightly, and promotional prospects were relatively poor, and a lot of people, young people like myself, were looking around to see where they could further their career. And I looked around, applied for several jobs. One of the jobs that I saw advertised was for a developing tin mine in Cornwall, and I thought that sounds quite good. I duly attended for interview and got the job. I was very aware that if I moved away from Nottinghamshire, then my whole life in the Observer Corps would disappear, or could disappear. And of course it was very important to me, and I didn't take that decision lightly. But at the end of the day, what you earn and what you do professionally in your life is somewhat more important than what at the end of the day was almost a hobby. And so I did actually move to Cornwall. The 8 group told me that they were very disappointed to lose me. I was regarded as one of the senior chief observers in 8 group. But on the good side, the Truro group welcomed me with open arms. Because I went to live in Camborne, actually, and I became the chief mining surveyor for Pendarvis Mine, south of Camborne. And the Truro group, which was number 11 group Truro, Coventry was number 8 group, Truro was number 11 group, they welcomed me with open arms, and they were actually short of staff in the ops room, or the control, in Truro. And so I was actually offered a post there, and duly started to meet there. And it was a total and utter change for me, because I'd been a chief observer on a post, you can call it the sharp end. We were the ones out in the sticks, taking the readings, the basic readings, for nuclear weapons and radioactive fallout. And here I was, in a full control room, with maps and boards and lady tellers and lady plotters and things like that. And it was really going from a very practical job to a very almost administrative job. And but I actually matched in with it very well. And I duly became the tape centre supervisor. The tape centre in a control was the place where all the data generated by the whole organisation actually came in on punched tape. And this was plotted by the plotters on a variety of different displays. So I duly became tape centre supervisor, and I was absolutely astounded when the full-time officer asked me to apply for a full-time officer, for a spare-time officer's job in the control. I was very conscious in those days that I'd only been in Cornwall for about a year, and I thought, this really isn't on, you know, because there must be local people who've been here ages who would want to apply for the officer's job. But anyway, he twisted my arm, I duly applied, and I got the job. And I've got to say, all the local people made me very welcome. I had no trouble whatsoever, and I've never had any trouble with local Cornish people, and now I regard myself almost as Cornish. My role as an officer was that of the duty controller. I was the person in control of the whole ops room for the period of my shift, as it were. There were 3 of us. A lovely man called Dick Mitchell and a lady called Daphne Stewart. She was also the full-time clerical officer for number 11 group Truro, and we were the 3 duty officers that ran the ops room. We each had a crew. Our crews were only about 20 strong, because I found out later that 11 group, although it was built as a full ops room, in a reorganisation in 68 had been reduced in status to that of a subgroup. It means that the work done there was not quite as big and as complex as a full group. And I became one of the duty officers in what was then called a subgroup. That continued, and we continued playing our nuclear war games in the ops room, plotting our maps, plotting our plumes, plotting our fallout decay rates and things like that. Every exercise, we had training meetings every week, just like on the posts. And that continued until 1973. And in 1973, as an economy measure, they decided to close down the Truro ops room, or the Truro control. But it was absolutely devastating to me, because I'd really tried to match in and tried to integrate, and I had done. And it was devastating to all the people that had put in a lot of effort. And but all the post telephone lines were rerouted so that the post didn't report to Truro, they reported to Exeter. Exeter was the next control room going eastwards, and in effect, Cornwall and Devon amalgamated, and it became 10 Group Exeter. For many, many years, people would say, "Where are you from?" And I would say, "10 Group Exeter." And they'd say, "Oh yes, where do you live in Exeter?" I said, "Well, I don't live in Exeter, I live in Truro." And they could not believe that anybody having a designation of 10 Group Exeter actually lived in Truro, which is 100 miles away. It was a slight unusual, because 10 Group was probably the longest group in the whole of the UK. A bit unusual in that sense. But anyway, when they closed down the Truro ops room, I and all the others became technically redundant. But in those days, you could actually transfer to any other unit that had a vacancy. Some people actually resigned altogether, but most people actually transferred to the posts. The posts were the only things that were left, actually, in Cornwall. I transferred to Madron Post, down north of Penzance, and I duly became the leading observer on that post. The Observer Corps was a very, very peculiar organisation in that you can be an officer, and if your unit closes down, you can revert from officer to observer. And then you can start climbing the ladder again.
So you can move up and down.
You can move up and down. Right. As far as I know, it's the only semi-military organisation that allows that. I'd already been leading observer, chief observer in Coventry Group. I then moved to 11 Group Truro and became observer, leading observer, and then officer. And then in 1973, I went down to observer again, and then quickly went up to leading observer. On Madron Post, lovely crowd of people, and I will mention a lovely lady called Lorna Buchanan, who was the chief woman observer there. She was so, I use the word loved, she was so much liked and loved that all the observers would have done the world for her. She was very socially minded. I suppose she wasn't particularly technically minded, but then she had a team of people who were technically minded, and she moulded that team into a very, very good post. And Madron Post was an exceedingly good post. A very spectacularly sighted post on the moors up above Penzance, very near Ding Dong Mine, and a very spectacular position. They'd got the above ground, the below ground post there in all the gorse and the bracken, and it's a very good post. After a while, I actually moved home from Camborne to Ladoc, and that necessitated a move of post. So I reluctantly moved from Madron Post to Mitchell Post. Mitchell Post was actually placed at Carlin Cross, we used to meet in St Newlyn East, and I became the observer on Mitchell Post. I duly became leading observer and then chief observer again. But I didn't like Mitchell Post. It was a much more poorly run post than Madron. The post personnel were not as enthusiastic or as able as Madron Post. And I did come within a whisker of actually resigning from the Observer Corps altogether. But then something else happened in 1975. Can we just stop it?
Yeah, sure, that's fine.